In the Fog. In the Fog. Chapter 1. The grill is the club most difficult of access in the world. To be placed on its rolls distinguishes the new member as greatly as though he had received a vacant garter or had been caricatured in Vanity Fair. Men who belong to the grill club never mention that fact. If you were to ask one of them which clubs he frequents, he will name all save that particular one. He is afraid if he told you he belonged to the grill, that it would sound like boasting. The Grill Club dates back to the days when Shakespeare's theater stood on the present side of the Times office. It has a golden grill which Charles II presented to the club, and the original manuscript of Tom and Jerry in London, which was bequeathed to it by Piers Egan himself. The members, when they write letters at the club, still use sand to blot the ink. The grill enjoys the distinction of having blackballed, without political prejudice, a prime minister of each party. At the same sitting at which one of these fell, it elected, on account of his brogue and his bulls, Quiller, Q.C., who was then a penniless barrister. When Paul Preval, the French artist who came to London by royal command to paint a portrait of the Prince of Wales, was made an honorary member, only foreigners may be honorary members, he said, as he signed his first wine card, I would rather see my name on that, than on a picture in the Louvre. At which Quiller remarked, that is a devil of a compliment, because the only men who can read their names in the Louvre today have been dead 50 years. On the night after the Great Fog of 1897 there were 5 members in the club, 4 of them busy with supper and 1 reading in front of the fireplace. There is only 1 room to the club, and 1 long table. At the far end of the room the fire of the grill glows red, and, when the fat falls, blazes into flame, and at the other there is a broad bow window of diamond panes, which looks down upon the street. The 4 men at the table were strangers to each other, but as they picked at the grilled bones, and sipped their scotch and soda, they conversed with such charming animation that a visitor to the club, which does not tolerate visitors, would have counted them as friends of long acquaintance, certainly not as Englishmen who had met for the first time, and without the form of an introduction. But it is the etiquette and tradition of the grill, that whoever enters it must speak with whomever he finds there. It is to enforce this rule that there is but 1 long table, and whether there are 20 men at it or 2, the waiters, supporting the rule, will place them side by side. For this reason the 4 strangers at supper were seated together, with the candles grouped about them, and the long length of the table cutting a white path through the outer gloom. I repeat, said the gentleman with the black pearl stud, that the days for romantic adventure and deeds of foolish daring have passed, and that the fault lies with ourselves. Voyages to the pole I do not catalogue as adventures. That African explorer, young Chetney, who turned up yesterday after he was supposed to have died in Uganda, did nothing adventurous. He made maps and explored the sources of rivers. He was in constant danger, but the presence of danger does not constitute adventure. Were that so, the chemist who studies high explosives, or who investigates deadly poisons, passes through adventures daily. No, adventures are for the adventurous. But one no longer ventures. The spirit of it has died of inertia. We are grown too practical, too just, above all, too sensible. In this room, for instance, members of this club have, at the sword's point, disputed the proper scanning of one of Pope's couplets. Over so weighty a matter as spilled burgundy on a gentleman's cuff, 10 men fought across this table, each with his rapier in one hand and a candle in the other. All 10 were wounded. The question of the spilled burgundy concerned but 2 of them. The 8 others engaged because they were men of spirit. They were, indeed, the first gentlemen of the day. Tonight, were you to spill burgundy on my cuff, were you even to insult me grossly, these gentlemen would not consider it incumbent upon them to kill each other. They would separate us, and tomorrow morning appear as witnesses against us at Bow Street. We have here tonight, in the persons of Sir Andrew and myself, an illustration of how the ways have changed. The men around the table turned and glanced toward the gentleman in front of the fireplace. He was an elderly and somewhat portly person, with a kindly, wrinkled countenance, which wore continually a smile of almost childish confidence and good nature. It was a face which the illustrated prince had made intimately familiar. He held a book from him at arm's length, as if to adjust his eyesight, and his brows were knit with interest. Now, were this the 18th century, continued the gentleman with the black pearl, when Sir Andrew left the club tonight I would have him bound and gagged and thrown into a sedan chair. The watch would not interfere, the passers-by would take to their heels, my hired bullies and ruffians would convey him to some lonely spot where we would guard him until morning. Nothing would come of it, except added reputation to myself as a gentleman of adventurous spirit, and possibly an essay in the Tatler, with stars for names, entitled, let us say, The Budget and the Baronet. But to what end, sir? Inquired the youngest of the members. And why, Sir Andrew, of all persons, why should you select him for this adventure? The gentleman with the black pearl shrugged his shoulders. It would prevent him speaking in the House tonight. The Navy increase bill, he added gloomily. It is a government measure, and Sir Andrew speaks for it. And so great is his influence and so large his following that if he does, the gentleman laughed ruefully, if he does, it will go through. Now, had I the spirit of our ancestors, he exclaimed, I would bring chloroform from the nearest chemist's and drug him in that chair. I would tumble his unconscious form into a hansom cab, and hold him prisoner until daylight. If I did, I would save the British taxpayer the cost of 5 more battleships, many millions of pounds. The gentleman again turned, and surveyed the baronet with freshened interest. The honorary member of the Grill, whose accent already had betrayed him as an American, laughed softly. To look at him now, he said, one would not guess he was deeply concerned with the affairs of state. The others nodded silently. He has not lifted his eyes from that book since we first entered, added the youngest member. He surely cannot mean to speak tonight. Oh, yes, he will speak, muttered the one with the black pearl moodily. During these last hours of the session the House sits late, but when the Navy Bill comes up on its third reading he will be in his place, and he will pass it. The fourth member, a stout and florid gentleman of a somewhat sporting appearance, in a short smoking jacket and black tie, sighed enviously. Fancy one of us being as cool as that, if he knew he had to stand up within an hour and rattle off a speech in Parliament. I'd be in a devil of a funk myself. And yet he is as keen over that book he's reading as though he had nothing before him until bedtime. Yes, see how eager he is, whispered the youngest member. He does not lift his eyes even now when he cuts the pages. It is probably an Admiralty report, or some other weighty work of statistics which bears upon his speech. The gentleman with the black pearl laughed morosely. The weighty work in which the eminent statesman is so deeply engrossed, he said, is called The Great Rand Robbery. It is a detective novel, for sale at all bookstalls. The American raised his eyebrows in disbelief. The Great Rand Robbery? He repeated incredulously. What an odd taste. It is not a taste, it is his vice, returned the gentleman with the pearl stud. It is his one dissipation. He is noted for it. You, as a stranger, could hardly be expected to know of this idiosyncrasy. Mr. Gladstone sought relaxation in the Greek poets, Sir Andrew finds his in Gaboriau. Since I have been a member of Parliament I have never seen him in the library without a shilling shocker in his hands. He brings them even into the sacred precincts of the House, and from the government benches reads them concealed inside his hat. Once started on a tale of murder, robbery, and sudden death, nothing can tear him from it, not even the call of the division bell, nor of hunger, nor the prayers of the party whip. He gave up his country house because when he journeyed to it in the train he would become so absorbed in his detective stories that he was invariably carried past his station. The member of Parliament twisted his pearl stud nervously, and bit at the edge of his mustache. If it only were the first pages of the Rand Robbery that he were reading, he murmured bitterly, instead of the last. With such another book as that, I swear I could hold him here until morning. There would be no need of chloroform to keep him from the house. The eyes of all were fastened upon Sir Andrew, and each saw with fascination that with his forefinger he was now separating the last two pages of the book. The Member of Parliament struck the table softly with his open palm. I would give £100, he whispered, if I could place in his hands at this moment a new story of Sherlock Holmes. £1,000, he added wildly, £5,000. The American observed the speaker sharply, as though the words bore to him some special application, and then at an idea which apparently had but just come to him, smiled in great embarrassment. Sir Andrew ceased reading, but, as though still under the influence of the book, sat looking blankly into the open fire. For a brief space no one moved until the baronet withdrew his eyes and, with a sudden start of recollection, felt anxiously for his watch. He scanned its face eagerly, and scrambled to his feet. The voice of the American instantly broke the silence in a high, nervous accent. And yet Sherlock Holmes himself, he cried, could not decipher the mystery which tonight baffles the police of London. At these unexpected words, which carried in them something of the tone of a challenge, the gentleman about the table started as suddenly as though the American had fired a pistol in the air, and Sir Andrew halted abruptly and stood observing him with grave surprise. The gentleman with the black pearl was the first to recover. Yes, yes, he said eagerly, throwing himself across the table. A mystery that baffles the police of London. I have heard nothing of it. Tell us at once, pray do, tell us at once. The American flushed uncomfortably, and picked uneasily at the tablecloth. No one but the police has heard of it, he murmured, and they only threw me. It is a remarkable crime, too, which, unfortunately, I am the only person who can bear witness. Because I am the only witness, I am, in spite of my immunity as a diplomat, detained in London by the authorities of Scotland Yard. My name, he said, inclining his head politely, is Sears, Lieutenant Ripley Sears of the United States Navy, at present naval attaché to the Court of Russia. Had I not been detained today by the police, I would have started this morning for Petersburg. The gentleman with the black pearl interrupted with so pronounced an exclamation of excitement and delight that the American stammered and ceased speaking. "Do you hear, Sir Andrew?" cried the Member of Parliament jubilantly. "An American diplomat halted by our police because he is the only witness of a most remarkable crime, the most remarkable crime, I believe you said, sir," he added, bending eagerly toward the naval officer, "which has occurred in London in many years." The American moved his head in assent and glanced at the two other members. They were looking doubtfully at him, and the face of each showed that he was greatly perplexed. Sir Andrew advanced to within the light of the candles and drew a chair toward him. "The crime must be exceptional indeed," he said, "to justify the police in interfering with a representative of a friendly power. If I were not forced to leave at once, I should take the liberty of asking you to tell us the details." The gentleman with the pearl pushed the chair towards Sir Andrew, and motioned him to be seated. "You cannot leave us now," he exclaimed. "Mr. Sears is just about to tell us of this remarkable crime." He nodded vigorously at the naval officer and the American, after first glancing doubtfully toward the servants at the far end of the room, leaned forward across the table. The others drew their chairs nearer and bent toward him. The baronet glanced irresolutely at his watch, and with an exclamation of annoyance snapped down the lid. "They can wait," he muttered. He seated himself quickly and nodded at Lieutenant Sears. "If you will be so kind as to begin, sir," he said impatiently. "Of course," said the American, "you understand that I understand that I am speaking to gentlemen. The confidences of this club are inviolate. Until the police give the facts to the public press, I must consider you my confederates. You have heard nothing, you know no one connected with this mystery. Even I must remain anonymous." The gentlemen seated around him nodded gravely. "Of course," the baronet assented with eagerness, "of course." "We will refer to it," said the gentleman with the black pearl, "as the story of the naval attaché." "I arrived in London 2 days ago," said the American, "and I engaged a room at the Bath Hotel. I know very few people in London, and even the members of our embassy were strangers to me. But in Hong Kong I had become great pals with an officer in your navy, who has since retired, and who is now living in a small house in Rutland Gardens opposite the Knightsbridge Barracks. I telegraphed him that I was in London, and yesterday morning I received a most hearty invitation to dine with him the same evening at his house. He is a bachelor, so we dined alone and talked over all our old days on the Asiatic station, and of the changes which had come to us since we had last met there. As I was leaving the next morning for my post at Petersburg, and had many letters to write, I told him, about 10 o'clock, that I must get back to the hotel, and he sent out his servant to call a hansom. For the next quarter of an hour, as we sat talking, we could hear the cab whistle sounding violently from the doorstep, but apparently with no result. It cannot be that the cabmen are on strike, my friend said, as he rose and walked to the window. He pulled back the curtains and at once called to me. "You have never seen a London fog, have you?" he asked. "Well, come here. This is one of the best, or, rather, one of the worst, of them." I joined him at the window, but I could see nothing. Had I not known that the house looked out upon the street, I would have believed that I was facing a dead wall. I raised the sash and stretched out my head, but still I could see nothing. Even the light of the street lamps opposite, and in the upper windows of the barracks, had been smothered in the yellow mist. The lights of the room in which I stood penetrated the fog only to the distance of a few inches from my eyes. Below me the servant was still sounding his whistle, but I could afford to wait no longer, and told my friend that I would try and find the way to my hotel on foot. He objected, but the letters I had to write were for the Navy Department, and, besides, I had always heard that to be out in a London fog was the most wonderful experience, and I was curious to investigate one for myself. My friend went with me to his front door, and laid down a course for me to follow. I was first to walk straight across the street to the brick wall of the Knightsbridge Barracks. I was then to feel my way along the wall until I came to a row of houses set back from the sidewalk. They would bring me to a cross street. On the other side of this street was a row of shops which I was to follow until they joined the iron railings of Hyde Park. I was to keep to the railings until I reached the gates at Hyde Park Corner, where I was to lay a diagonal course across Piccadilly, and tack in toward the railings of Green Park. At the end of these railings, Going east, I would find the Walsingham, and my own hotel. To a sailor the course did not seem difficult, so I bade my friend goodnight and walked forward until my feet touched the paving. I continued upon it until I reached the curbing of the sidewalk. A few steps further, and my hands struck the wall of the barracks. I turned in the direction from which I had just come, and saw a square of faint light cut in the yellow fog. I shouted "All right," and the voice of my friend answered, "Good luck to you." The light from his open door disappeared with a bang, and I was left alone in a dripping, yellow darkness. I have been in the Navy for 10 years, but I have never known such a fog as that of last night, not even among the icebergs of Bering Sea. There one at least could see the light of the binnacle, but last night I could not even distinguish the hand by which I guided myself along the barrack wall. At sea, a fog.